Hello and welcome to Playback.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
If Donald Trump were president, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv right now. And understand what that would mean, because Putin's agenda is not just about Ukraine. Why don't you tell the 800,000 Polish Americans right here in Pennsylvania how quickly you would give up for the sake of favor and what you think is a friendship with what is known to be a dictator who would eat you for lunch?
Tuesday night's televised debate between U.S. presidential candidates Donald Trump and Kamala Harris certainly enlivened the airwaves on Wednesday. So who came out on top? Business Post reporter Marion McKeown was in no doubt when she gave Claire Byrne her assessment.
I think that she performed really above expectations in it, you know, just from having watched the entire debate and seeing how she really took control from the moment she walked on stage. And she's physically not a big woman. She's probably about 5'4", maybe wearing a 2-inch heel. Donald Trump is 6'2", 6'3". And she went over to him and basically made him shake hands with her. She invaded his part of the stage. I mean, no, all these body language experts tell us all about that, about claiming your space. And then really from the get-go, she did things that a prosecutor would do. There were moments where I was reminded of a Law and Order episode where she said, you know, basically the other side is going to just tell you a load of lies and grievances and the same old playbook. So she didn't just set out her stall. She also set out his stall for him, Donald Trump's, which of course he wouldn't have liked at all. And then just the needling and the expressions. I mean, her expressions were, she looked at him with bemusement at times. She looked at him with what looked like pity at times. There were times when she just laughed at what he said. But you could see that at times it looked as if to go, you know, I'm really trying to figure out what is wrong with you. Like, she was really giving him that look of almost the way you'd look at some strange thing you didn't really recognize. And I think it was all calculated to get under his skin. And then she got very tough. She landed some pretty brutal barbs and knowingly, and, you know, talk about walking somebody into a trap. And just one of the examples, and I'm sure it's one you're familiar with already, was the immigration thing question came up. And that is one of her biggest vulnerabilities. She's mentioned how Donald Trump had killed the border security bill, that the bipartisan one that she and Joe Biden had put together out of self-interest because he wanted to keep it as a live issue for the election. But then she segued into talking about his rallies and said, you know, he talks about everything, Hannibal Lecter, blah, 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 and then said, but what you'll notice if you go to one of them is halfway through, people start leaving early out of exhaustion and boredom. And you could see Trump's eyes just pop up immediately. And, you know, the fury on his face. And then he immediately then, like, he had a chance to go back and hit her on immigration because he was asked by the moderator then to respond to the allegation he had killed the bill, and he went straight into Haitians eating cats and dogs in Springfield, Ohio. You know, this appalling rumor that is not just thoroughly debunked by the city authorities, but one that is so inherently racist, so virulent. And these immigrants who are in Springfield, Ohio, are all legally there. They all have work permits. They are perfectly legal. And to spread this around and say, and then when he was fact checked on that, he said, well, I saw it on TV. They're using the dogs for food. It was like the most bizarre moment you could imagine in a debate exchange.
Later on the news at 1, Journal.ie columnist and University of Galway lecturer Larry Donnelly was of the opinion that Donald Trump made the mistake of preaching to the converted instead of targeting the undecided voter.
That's Trump's greatest weakness. He has a lot of political strengths, but his greatest weakness is that he treats every public engagement like it's a rally. And I think he thinks that the you know, his diehards are enough to get him over the line. The biggest problem for him last night was he didn't lose any of his diehards, but he didn't do a damn thing to get any of the floating voters who were going to decide this thing over the line, to bring him to his side. And that's where I think Kamala Harris and her team can take some credit for last night. She was extremely well prepared, and how she approached the issues, I thought, was superb, especially for somebody who has struggled in those things in the past. So all in all, a really good night for her, a bad night for Trump. But make no mistake, this thing has got a long way to go.
And what are we to make of Taylor Swift's endorsement of Kamala Harris? Will she help Kamala Harris to shake off Donald Trump?
Do not underestimate it. Some in the professional political class are prone to dismissing these sorts of things. But in a celebrity-obsessed culture, and with somebody who is an absolute megastar in Taylor Swift, who wields huge influence over vast swathes of America, and let's not forget, a lot of them tend to be apolitical people, people who aren't engaged. If this thing is close, and she can get a few thousand voters, young people in particular, to the polls in the battleground states, her support could potentially be decisive. So do not dismiss it.
I never dismiss Taylor Swift.
Justin McCarthy talking to Larry Donnelly on the News at One. Now, while last week's Paralympics brought lots of new names to our attention, Ellen Keane is perhaps one of Ireland's best known Paralympic competitors. Although Paris didn't deliver a medal for her, she received lots of support from Irish fans during the Games and again this week when she announced her retirement. When Ellen chatted to Brendan Courtney, standing in for Oliver Callan, he asked her, was she gutted when she didn't win a medal?
It was weird. It was like when I hit the wall and I turned around, it kind of takes a while to register the times that you see and the numbers that you see beside your name. So I was just a bit shook that it said four instead of one, two or three, just because I'd had those numbers beside my name for so many years. But like even as I was getting out of the water, I know people were expecting me to be absolutely heartbroken, but I didn't feel it. So when I got to Orty and I was talking to Orty post-race, like what I said was real. Like I really, 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 really tried and I gave it my all and it just didn't happen. And like I've been on the podium for so long, consistently so many years, and it just wasn't meant to be. And it kind of felt like a sign to me that, yeah, it's time. You don't owe anyone anything anymore. People can't question why you're retiring when you're still on top of the podium. Like, it's time now. And it was really it was a really lovely day as well because Roisin won her first Paralympic medal and it kind of felt like passing of the guard or changing of the guard.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, it really did. And I actually think it helped.
You're such
it
a honey, Ellen.
Well.
You really are. You just blow my mind. You're making me tear me up here. And you said, yeah, I've already done it and I've already made my peace with it. Your quote is a saying.
Yeah, yeah. And do you know what? I think just the emotions of the whole experience was kind of what was kind of the thing that was making me cry. And I cried afterwards more so because it was over rather than I'd come forth and I saw my boyfriend straight away and like I didn't feel like I could cry until I was with him. And then Roisin actually walked past me and it was the first time I'd seen her since she'd gone and got her medal because I was in the call room waiting to race when she was racing it and that's where I saw her win. But she walked past me and I called after her and I ran after her and she like hugged me but she was looking at me so concerned and because Roisin has come forth so many times as well. So she knew how it felt. And I literally looked at her and I was like, I'm okay. I promise I'm okay. And I want you to enjoy this. So like we had a lovely little moment too, but
wow.
Yeah, it's just been, and even like when I had put up my post and before I'd put up my post the next day, the amount of love and support I have received has been incredible. And I just felt like the whole of Ireland was giving me one big hug. Because I felt like people know what it feels like to lose. And I think everyone could relate to that. And like not a lot of people can relate to winning. And it's easy to celebrate a win, but I feel like the whole of Ireland were really, really quick to make sure that they looked after me after that race, which I really, really, really felt.
And the Roisin who Ellen mentioned there on a couple of occasions was, of course, Paralympics medal winner Roisin Nurein. Now, journalist and disability rights activist Joanne O'Riordan was also in Paris this year, but in her role reporting on rather than competing in the Games. On Monday's Morning Ireland, she told Audrey Carville how liberating an experience it was to spend time around the Paralympics village.
I guess I was in the village for a good couple of days during the punditry and I suppose I saw the quote-unquote disability utopia according to one of the Norwegian swimmers. And I think what it looked like really was, you know, the first day I went in, people came in with prosthetics. They had their cosmetic cases over them. By about day three or four, the cosmetic cases were gone and people were admiring the tech and the skill and whatnot, or whatever the arms or the legs were doing. They were not looking at the wheelchairs anymore. All the staff were able to assist people, you know, along the way in terms of their food and whatever they needed. All the ramps were available, and everything was kind of there. And it was actually really bizarre. I think it was the first place that I actually felt fully independent without a care, that I was able to drive around, get my food, go to the toilet, do whatever I needed to do. And yeah, for me, it was a total revolution. I've never seen anything like that before.
And outside of the village, Joanne, what was it like, do you know? Because I was listening to a journalist last night on the BBC who was there doing what you were doing, and he said that there was one metro line in the whole of Paris that's accessible to those with disabilities. There were only 8 train stations, and at one stage he had to crawl on his elbows to get off a train because there was no other way to do it.
Yeah, like, honestly, that doesn't surprise me. You know, I had the exact same experience too over there. We published a video online for RT Sport about a wheelchair user getting around, and it was the exact same kind of situation. In fact, I was going to the La Défense Arena for the swimming and they put me on the Stade de France metro line. So I don't know what that meant in terms of that situation. There were volunteers aplenty, don't get me wrong, left, right and centre, and they were all adamant that they wanted to help. And, you know, you ask one person to help you, you have 4 people around you looking for a ramp. So, you know, the will was there, but I just don't think the way was, if that makes sense.
Audrey also asked Joanne about the kind of changes that need to be made to nurture more Irish Paralympians.
It's about attitudes, it's about mindset. You know, I remember in my primary school, PE time was me being a referee rather than actually being involved or being on the sideline or anything like that. I suppose I wasn't actively engaged in sport as well. And I suppose the grand old age of 28, I've had to go out of my own way to try and get myself involved in different types of activities. You know, I go to the gym, I do yoga, I do Pilates, but that's because the teachers and the instructors that I have are able to kind of think outside the box, and they're able to try and figure out, okay, this is how it works. And that's a collaborative approach as well. Like, I see exercises and stuff I want to do and I say it to them, and then they go away for a few days and think about it. But I think it's investment needed all around. You know, I mean, you rock up to, you know, I've been trying to get into a swim club now for the last few years, but there's no volunteer able to take me, or it's not adequately set up, you know. And I suppose it is deflating as a person with a disability. You get the confidence to reach out to say, hey, I want to do this. And it's not that you're met with a firm no, it's you're met with a kind of like, oh, it's a bit tricky, isn't it? And that's the last thing you want to hear about your existence, is that it's a bit tricky.
Joanne O'Riordan talking to Audrey Carvel on Monday. David Ryan and his brother Mark featured in the BlackRock Boys Doc on One, which led to the scoping inquiry into allegations of sexual abuse in religious-run schools in Ireland. In his first interview since last week's report from that inquiry was published, David spoke to RT's social affairs correspondent Alva Keneally.
It's great it has come out, and I'm thrilled that it has, for Mark's and my sake. Just, it's actually come out and the ball is starting to roll at long last. The phones have not stopped ringing, constant ringing. How am I? What do you think? I'm being honest, I haven't read the report. It's just too much, too raw, too soon. I'll do it in my own time. But what has come out, I'm happy with. There are mixed emotions, what people are saying. Some people aren't too happy, some people are happy. But I'm going to sit on the fence at the moment. I'll do it in my own time when I'm ready. My perpetrators have all died, unfortunately. I never got them to justice. I never got justice from them. So we have to work forward now that the perpetrators that are alive, they have got to be brought in and tried for these other victims that have come forward.
And how did you find the actual scoping inquiry itself?
It was very, very tough. And it's like your personal life, you're telling somebody that you don't really know. But if I don't do it, they're not going to know. So I had to just grin and bear it and just do it. It was a tough, tough day, a really tough day. Some people were in for a couple of hours. I know Mark was in for over 2.5 hours doing his. I don't know how long I was. I was there for a while, but it's tough. A lot of questions, but if you don't answer the questions, they can't go any further with it. So the more they got, the more they can do. And they've 700 pages. There you go.
So the commission of investigation, you want it done as quick as possible?
Quick as it has to. It cannot go on and put back and put back. I mean, I never know when I'm going to go. I mean, I would like this before I go, for my sake and for Mark's. You know, it just has to come. And an apology, another one. I know Bertie O'Hearn did his, but another one has to be done now, because there's more people that have been hurt, severely hurt. And the pain is still there. I mean, we're all suffering still. It'll never go. They'll always be there. But I'm able to cope with it better. All right, there are dark days still. I mean, there's certain anniversaries, certain dates that it'll always just trigger straight away. But I'm learning to cope with it.
With the first anniversary of his brother Mark's death approaching, Ava asked David how he plans to mark the day.
I think the grief has only kind of hit me when this all started coming. You know, I have his photographs in my bedroom and his urn is up in the room with me, and the awards that we got for the .com one are all there. Every day I see him and he has that smile on his face, and I said, look at you, Mark Ryan. So we are marking it. It's going to be just a private one, just with family and close friends. As you know, Mark went on the Asgard when he was younger, and what we are going to do, I'm taking his ashes on a friend's boat on the Saturday, and we're going to go into Dublin Bay and we're going to push his ashes out in Dublin Bay. And that's his final farewell, which will be tough. Yeah. It will be very, very tough.
David Ryan, as heard on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
I believe this inquiry can be a watershed moment in the difficult subject of legacy in this part of our island. If a public inquiry into the murder of Pat Finucane can finally public examine all of the collusion that plagued our society for so many years, then there is hope that the real process of healing can begin.
That was Pat Finucane's widow Geraldine giving her reaction to the British government's announcement this week that there is to be a public inquiry into his killing. So why has it taken so long for this to happen? And why has the British government always been so reluctant to undertake an inquiry of this nature? Former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern gave Justin McCarthy his perspective on Wednesday's News at One.
I've argued this with Tony Blair, Gordon Brown too. You know, there's not a great number of secrets about what happened. What happened was there was a patrol, an RUC patrol, on his estate, and it was withdrawn for a period of time, which allowed the UDA, the paramilitaries, to go in and kill him. And the case was always that there was collusion between that particular group and with the police. And Pat was shot 14 times in the process. And every time I think we made progress, we got to the stage that the files and the records in MI5 would not be given, because that's where they were. And there was always the belief, and something I hold dearly, I can't prove it, but that MI5 were part of this. But what we can prove is that when Judge Carey was doing this investigation, MI5 went into his office in London and took some of his hard drives. So MI5 were all over this. Mm. So if it's an inquiry, Justin, it'll have to, in the terms of reference, the cooperation from MI5, which, you know, is not something we didn't get it in the Dublin man and bombings, and so we'll see whether it comes out in this. So if it's to be of any meaningful thing, the small print of this will be to see whether we have access to MI5 records, which will be groundbreaking, but I wish Hilary Benn and his efforts well.
On Thursday, Pat Finucane's only daughter, Catherine, gave her response to the previous day's announcement to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland.
To be honest, it's still very surreal. Yesterday was a crazy day. It really hasn't sunk in yet. And for all of us, really, I think it's going to take a few days before it really does sink in and we realise what has actually happened.
Your mother said yesterday that she was surprised at the news of a public inquiry. Were you?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, 35 years is a very long time to be getting the bad news that we continually got with all the different government officials that we met. You know, you sort of get used to just going to these meetings and being told bad news. So when we got the news that we wanted evening before last, it really was very hard to take in, given the history.
You were very young when your father was murdered. What's it been like for you to carry the memory of what happened to your dad?
Well, yeah, I was 12 when my father was murdered. My younger brother John was 8 and Michael was 17. So yes, it's been incredibly difficult. I mean, we've carried this our whole lives, really. You know, so it has been very difficult, but we're strong. We're a strong family. We're close, and we all have our own children now too. So having our own children has made us more motivated to carry on with the campaign and to provide a better future for them.
How do you remember him, Catherine?
Well, he was, you know, I was his only girl. So I guess some people say that I was the blue-eyed girl. You know, he liked a good laugh. He was always joking, and just like any dad, you know, just like messing with us. And he loved going on holiday, and we had nice holidays together, you know, so that's how I remember him.
Another daughter who was heard remembering her father on air this week was Ciara Dignam. Her dad, Christy Dignam, is one of four singers honoured on a new set of postage stamps which were launched this week. Ciara told RTÉ Arts and Media correspondent Evelyn O'Rourke how she feels about the news and what she thinks her dad would have made of it all.
I wasn't sure what to think at four, to be honest with you. I was doing my shopping, so I was in an aisle in Tesco's when I got the phone call, and I was kind of thinking, is this some sort of joke? But because it was such a random call to get when you're not expecting it, but such a lovely, lovely idea. We're really, for my dad to be honoured in this way, it's such an unusual thing. Like, it's with grief, it's a tough and long road, but when something like this, to show that, like, I don't think with a lot of my dad's fans and in this country, I don't think he's going to be forgotten too quick. But for something like this, it's amazing.
I thought it was interesting that David McGredman, the CEO, said, you know, we don't have an honours list in Ireland, but what we do is we put people on stamps. This has to be approved by the cabinet, you know, the highest level of the government. What does that mean to hear that?
I actually didn't know that until he said it. I obviously, it's the normal Joe Soap like myself wouldn't know the ins and outs of these things, but when he said that, I was like, oh my God. So to know it went to cabinet and the government have to approve it, so I was saying, God, like, even that, I think my dad would have a good giggle.
Why do you think he'd laugh though?
Well, he had a very dark humour anyway, and he had an opinion on everything, including politics. And so I think for this, something like this, he would be kind of, as soon as I heard about it, I was saying he would love this in a way that he'd be laughing, saying, God, I'm like the Queen on a stamp. But yeah, he'd love it.
Our Lives in the North is a new series which got an airing after Drive Time on Radio 1 this week, and which is also available to podcast. It's made by Una Kelly, and as the title suggests, it explores all facets of life in Northern Ireland. In this excerpt from an episode dedicated to education, Una pays a visit to a school in East Belfast.
For all the ways that children can be separated in the North, there's one school that really subverts expectations. In the Protestant stronghold of East Belfast, I get an Irish lesson from a four-year-old.
Can you tell me your name, please?
It's Maeve.
Maeve, can you teach me a wee bit of Irish?
Okay. Do you did, because I'm my daddy.
So what does that all mean, Maeve?
It means hello, how are you, good?
Maeve and her mother, Natalie McDowell, are in Ní School na Seolta, an Irish medium nursery school. The sector is growing in the north. There are around 8,000 pupils. But this is the only integrated school that teaches through Irish. It's currently based in a Presbyterian church, but there are plans to expand into a primary school on a nearby site. Linda Irvine is the school founder.
It's very mixed. You know, some of our children would just be Protestant from Protestant backgrounds. Some of them would just be Catholic from Catholic backgrounds. You know, we have some newcomer families as well who've been part of the journey too. But what we're finding is a lot of our children are others, and the parents are mixed marriages. And, you know, so you have one Catholic, one Protestant. So that's quite typical of our parents. And I suppose they are symbolic of the new Northern Ireland, of the way things are changing, opportunities for people to mix together. And, you know, what they're saying is, I don't want to sign up to one thing or the other, and that's why we feel that they're choosing integrated education.
For From life in the north to life in Afghanistan, it's 3 years since the Taliban took control of that country. And on Wednesday's News at One, Professor Michael Semple of Queen's University and former Deputy EU Envoy to Afghanistan spoke about what life has been like since.
If we were standing on pretty much any street in Kabul and taking a glance around us, at first glance, it would look sort of normal. There are people out on the streets. Obviously, shops are open. There's traffic on the roads. And then you start to look more closely and you realize it is anything but normal. And you can start to see some indications of how miserable life is for much of the population. For starters, I mean, obviously, we have to start with women. They look around in the streets of Kabul. Yeah, there are women out, but they are very, very much covered up, and they are trying to work out how on earth they respond to the latest edicts, which go completely against the culture which they have observed for decades, telling them that, you know, women have got to be so covered that they even have to cover their faces, and that they're not allowed to step out of the house unless they're accompanied by a chaperone. That's not the way that Afghan women live. It's particularly not the way that Kabul women live. It's tough on women. But men are being harassed as well. I mean, that under the Taliban, there's essentially arbitrary rule with these sort of, arbitrary rules are imposed by these gangs of their enforcers who are mullahs wearing white lab coats or doctor's coats who are empowered to stop anybody on the street or at a roadside checkpoint. Yeah, complain about the length of your beard, threaten to lock you up for a few days if your beard is not the right length, and, you know, punish the male of the male guardian, as they designate it, of women who are, you know, out and about without being properly accompanied. But that's, even then, that's only a superficial version of the way that the Taliban have tried to control Afghan society. You know, free speech is out the window. Now, Afghanistan includes many free-spirited people. So the Taliban have really had the work cut out for them in trying to prevent criticism of their regime, which they have, of course, banned. So much of the media which existed up to 2021 has simply been closed down. All the media which does exist is carefully watched by the Taliban, and the journalists are threatened and told to check reporting with them before they actually go out on air. But of course, Afghans do find ways around it. Some brave Afghans even go on the normal TV stations and speak their mind. But social media, it's taken the space that the legacy media used to occupy, so that Afghans share stories of the poverty, the indignity that they suffer, and also of the localized protests, not quite risings, but getting to the stage of local risings against Taliban rule. It's all shared on social media.
From Tuesday's News at One. Shifting sands on Dublin's Portmarnock beach over the summer revealed three previously undocumented shipwrecks and another which hasn't been visible for 7 years. To find out more about the work the National Monument Service is doing there, Eastern correspondent Samantha Labrary went out to Portmarnock, where she met senior archaeologist Carl Brady.
Oh, it was really amazing because I've been walking this beach for 25 years recording wrecks, and I've never seen as many wrecks uncovered, so it was really exciting.
This stretch of the eastern seaboard has quite the history when it comes to shipwrecks. Around 50 have been recorded in the Portmarnock Baldoyle area, some dating back as far as the 14th century. The National Monument Service says the figure is unusually high, and they found the physical remains of 13 of these vessels. Although they're still working to confirm their origins, they think they may be able to identify two of the three new vessels. Carl Brady again.
We would look at specialist maritime sources, such as Stark newspapers, Lloyd's Register, Lloyd's List. And then we try and match up and align the historic records with the vessel we see on the shore. And this can be quite a kind of difficult and challenging task because very often not very much remains of the ship itself. And we have to carry out a lot of detective work to try and kind of match the historic record to confirm the identity of the wreck. From looking at the wrecks we have recorded on this stretch of beach, we can tell that most of them weren't destined to come into Balldoyle or Malahide, but they're actually trying to get into Hoat Harbour or Dublin Port. But unfortunately, due to bad weather, maybe poor navigation, travelling at night, and maybe a bit of unluck, they were driven ashore during storms onto this beach. And when we analysed the records, we have a good match of a shipwreck going ashore very close to this point called the Milfilatry, but was travelling from Cardiff to Dublin at Christmas time in 1899 and encountered a ferocious storm. And we know that the ship lost control and was driven ashore at this point here. The crew at the stage were forced to climb the rigging to try and prevent themselves from being washed overboard by the huge monstrous waves. And it wasn't until the next morning that they were able to be rescued by the local coast guard. The other wreck, we think it's called the Gainsborough, and it's a well-known wreck in the area because there's a monument in Malahide as a memorial to the crew that were lost on this vessel, which was travelling from Liverpool with a valuable cargo worth over £11,000 at the time. So it would have been many multiples of that in today's money. And again, this vessel was washed ashore during a storm. Unfortunately, it was at night time and the crew couldn't get ashore, so they too had to lash themselves to the rigging to prevent them getting washed ashore. Now, the local lifeboat crews here made valiant attempts to rescue the crew, but every time they went out in their little kind of basically rowboats, the lifeboat filled with water, and they eventually could get out to the vessel and rescue four of the crew. But unfortunately, three of the sailors were lost during that event.
Another seafaring tale which featured in the news this week was that of Tom Dolan, who became the first ever Irishman to win the gruelling Solitaire du Figaro Paperec solo race off the coast of France. He spoke to Gavin Jennings a few hours after he'd won the race on Thursday morning.
The race, it was a bit intense. It's a three week long. It's a kind of like the Tour de France of offshore single-handed sailing, I suppose. You do three 4 day legs, and all about 600 miles long, and it's the overall time of all of them that counts.
How much sleep do you get when you're at sea, Tom?
Not a whole lot. It depends on the weather. The last one was a bit hairy. We went from France around up to the south coast of England and then back down again to France, and it was a bit windy, hairy on the south coast of England, so everyone's a bit tired.
And you're on your own for all of it.
Exactly, yeah. Single-handed sailing, it's called.
Were there particular rough points?
Yesterday or 2 days ago, I think, along the south coast of England, we were in a gale, more or less. We were in a gale, and I was only an hour behind the first person, so he got a bit of a head start in the strong conditions, so I couldn't see him anymore, so I was getting a bit worried, because I was thinking an hour's not a whole lot of time, so if he goes a bit faster than I do, what'll happen?
So,
sorry, I'm a bit wrecked.
That's okay, Tom.
Waited for about 4 hours in the last 4 days.
So listen, after 3 weeks at sea, can you describe your feelings of as you were coming into the home stretch, as you were finishing up?
I got a bit emotional, to be honest. I've been here, I've been in France for the last 12 years. You know, when I got over here, the dream was just to be able to do this race. I never, ever would have imagined winning it. It's a fairly French-dominated sport. So, and to be honest, I haven't slept since I got in. It hasn't sunk in yet.
What are you going to do now?
I'm going to sleep. Tomorrow I'm going to get up and I'm going to have a big, huge steak, and then I'm going to think about what's next.
your accent, Tom. It's a lovely mix of your 12 years in France and Kells in County Meath. Now, I'm from not far away from you, Navan. There's not an awful lot of water where we grew up. How did you get into sailing?
No, I up in Loch Ramor in Virginia. It was the owlad bought a little wooden dinghy. We used to go out and sail up in Loch Ramor. Every now and again, I wasn't exactly a big sailor. And then I kind of stopped because it wasn't really cool back in the day. So only got back into it in later years.
Well, listen, congratulations. Enjoy the rest of the day. Enjoy the feed. Enjoy the sleep. Would you do it again?
I will, yeah, I hope so. I'm a bit hooked.
From the high seas to outer space now, no doubt you'll already have heard about the first ever privately funded walk in space that happened this week. On Thursday, extragalactic astronomer and podcast host Dr. Jennifer Millard told Claire Byrne all about the mission and the millionaire behind it.
So Jared Isaacman has been to space before, but the others haven't. Imagine that. There's two of them going on this spacewalk. So it's Jared Isaacman and then Sarah Gillis. imagine your first time into space and you're going to be out there in the vacuum of space. You're going to leave your cabin behind. It's absolutely extraordinary. But these are the sort of experimental missions we need as we move towards a future where we have people living and working in space for years at a time, if that's on the surface of the moon or even eventually when we head off to Mars. Realistically, we don't have time to train people for years and years and years. They're going to have to do this shorter mm-hmm. training. So experimenting with this now is exactly the direction we need to go in.
Well, how does the traditional astronomy community feel about this, about billionaires booming off into space at the drop of a hat?
It's always a very mixed opinion. I've got mixed opinions about this. I feel like the ones where these missions are short hops to the edge of space, you know, it's Jeff Bezos and Virgin Galactic, where you just go over that Kármán line of 100 kilometres above the surface of the Earth and you're technically in space by definitions, but you're up there for 3-4 minutes in weightlessness. Those I'm kind of like, I feel like that's just rich people having a bit of a play around. But this mission is different. It's really dangerous. There is no one up there to save them. They're up there under their own wits and, of course, whatever communication they can get from the ground. There's no support from the International Space Station. If something goes wrong, we can't send another capsule up to try and save them. This is a proper breaking space mission. They really are making new ground, testing boundaries, smashing records. For me, this is a proper private space mission. So this one, I don't mind.
Okay, you don't mind this one.
From Today with Claire Byrne on Thursday. George Hamilton announced this week that he's leaving RTE Sport after 40 years with the station. He spoke to Cormac and Sarah on Drive Time about the highlights of his career.
I came back from London in 1984, and shortly after that, Jack Charlton was appointed manager of the Republic of Ireland football team. And we know what happened over the next 10 years. And mine was the voice that accompanied Jack Charlton's team through all those adventures. So I got really, really lucky like that. Had that not happened, who knows? You might never have heard of me because I was part of the family that was the Jack Charlton Roadshow.
What stands out for you, George, looking back at your commentary career?
Well, you see, the one, I always say the first one was the best. That was the Ray Houghton against England in Stuttgart in 1988. And the reason for that was manifold, because I had studied German and French at uni and lived in Germany for a time. And I had friends in Germany. And one of them was a radio producer in Stuttgart who became our gopher around that match. So we had a wonderful time being taken hither and yon in Stuttgart. We were on top of the gig. And then when we went into the gig, I was interviewed on German TV before it. I was asked what I thought the result would be. I said, I think 0-0. 1-0 would be wonderful, but 0-0 will do. And halfway through the second half, the commentator who had interviewed me sent a little note down the line to us saying, what's the English for ein Traum wird Wirklichkeit, a dream becomes reality or a dream comes true? Because he was commentating on the basis of what the Irish commentator had told him before the game. So that's why that stands out above all, not only because of my own personal feeling, not only because of what Ray Houghton did, not only because of the victory, but of all the things that came together that day in June in 1988. So that's a standout. Of course, Ray Houghton and Giant Stadium's another standout. Sonny O'Sullivan winning the World Championship in Gothenburg in 1995. Brian O'Driscoll scoring his hat-trick of tries in Paris. You know, all these things. Like, I have been so lucky in what I've had the opportunity to do with RTE over all the years.
I was watching back that particular one, the moment in 1990 when Ireland was heading for the World Cup, and that moment where you said the nation holds its breath. But after Paddy Bonner saved the penalty just in advance of that, what really struck me was you didn't say anything really. You shouted and then you let the crowd speak. You know, we could just hear the roar of the crowd and we heard the atmosphere. And I was just wondering how much of being a commentator is knowing when to shut up.
Most of it, to be quite honest. Because if you think about it, in that moment, nobody's going to hear what you're saying if you do say anything. That's one side of it, because they're all going to be cheering themselves. And the fact is that you're there to augment the picture. The picture is two-dimensional and you're supposed to add to the picture. And if the picture tells the story and the sound effects accompanying the picture tell the story, well, then there's nothing else for it but to shut up.
And before he signed off, Cormac asked George to deliver one of his trademark phrases.
Give us one more danger here, just to wrap
danger
it up.
Here.
Oh, there is danger here. Danger here.
George Hamilton, as heard on Drive Time on Wednesday. Robert Sheehan first appeared on our screens in RTE's Love Hate, but since then he's gone on to become an internationally acclaimed actor. He spoke to Brendan O'Connor last weekend about how he's always struggled with being famous.
Yeah, I struggled with it because Netflix's distribution is completely worldwide. There's only about five or six countries that Netflix isn't in. And Umbrella Academy got a big marketing push. It was brilliant. It became a hit show. But then people's responses to me on the street became very different because of the distribution of the show. You know, my life hadn't changed per se, but the amount of people that I was put in front of changed massively. And so it kind of changed people's reactions. So people became very deferential and very kind of gave me a lot of seniority. Strange.
Yeah.
A strange kind of reverence, you know.
It's weird, and, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's to do with, I think, just how many human beings that you're exposed to, you know.
So it's, but and that's it, bigger. It's bigger than having a big movie or whatever. Something hits on Netflix, like that's yeah. These days, that's like absolute worldwide unhandleable fame.
Global, yeah. And I think
so you can't go anywhere. Like
what started in me, there was a few things that happened with strangers,
like what?
That I wasn't prepared for. Well, you know, drunkies kind of getting you in a half headlock, going, come here, do a picture with my girlfriend, you know, and sort of being heavy handed with their energy. And what's
so people that say pity about you, so you're being paid plenty of money to have put up with yeah. this, like you're not being paid for the acting, you're being paid for that.
Yeah,
kind of nonsense,
and
like.
And I think I started to suffer under the idea that I had to give people what they wanted or whatever latest whim they were possessed by was my job to give it to them, you know. So there wasn't enough self-compassion there that came along with the fame. And I think in the absence of self-compassion, the kind of fame narrative in my head started to be, I don't like fame. I don't like how it feels to be in public. And that story took root,
did you
know, in the form of confirmation
out, like?
Biases. Yeah, you know, I mean, I started to kind of tend towards staying away from crowds and staying away from certain demographics of people where I knew they'd all recognise me. And, you know, I started to kind of limit my life.
You do mention, kind of just in passing, really, that friends and family dynamics can change as well when a person becomes famous really
yeah.
quickly. Yeah.
I start to represent something entirely else in their community and people start talking about me to them, okay. you know, in a very different way. So it starts to affect them directly. And then, you know, for example, my mother works part time in the local theatre in Portlaoise, in Dunamaze. And, you know, when the young ones found out that she was my mother, you know, they were like, oh, Christ, I can't believe that you're Robert Sheehan's mum. And so it does have a direct and somewhat daily effect on their lives. And so it was new territory for us all to kind of handle.
Returning now to sport and to Cormac and Sarah on Drive Time. Wasn't a great start for the new Republic of Ireland manager with 2 out of 2 defeats. After our first loss to England, Kenny Cunningham was critical of him for delegating selection responsibilities to his coaching staff.
Now, he's had enough time. He wasn't parachuted into the job 48 hours ago, Sarah. You know, he's been in the job for 2 months, so I would have thought he's been using that time. He's probably watched at least the last 20 to 30 of these games, international games. I would have thought so. So in terms of the actual individual qualities of the players, their strengths and weaknesses, he would have seen that on video footage. Now, I understand he won't have met the players personally and he won't have formed opinions in terms of their personality and their maybe characters, etc. But in terms of the qualities which they have as footballers, I'm sure he would have known on that. So if I was him, I'd be personally going to the training pitch and set the team up in the way I wanted to.
Come on, Kenny, come on, because if he did, you'd be picking holes in what he said straight off the bat.
But he's a manager. He's only had
4 or 5 days, for God's sake. What we know about him is that he's steady, he's calm, he's independent, you know, and this is what he is doing now. He's saying, I'm my own man.
He's not a piñata.
For you and the likes of you to take pots at him after his first interview.
I'm entitled to an opinion. I'm not particularly taking a pot at him. I'm giving an opinion and I'm very surprised. I've never had anything like it before. A manager going to an international camp 4 days lead up to a game and saying, look, I'm not going to take responsibility for the setup of the team.
Maybe,
he's the manager. He's the manager of the team.
Maybe this is what we need. Somebody who's independent, who's calm, who's steady.
We should have given the job. Well, give the job to John O'Shea. Leave him in his dentist surgery back in Iceland and let John take on the job.
Kenny, come on.
From Wednesday's Drive Time. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, here's Ryan McMullen, who was a guest on the Ray Darcy Show on Friday. He played a song made famous by a band that have received a bit of coverage in recent weeks. They're called Oasis. This is Don't Look Back in Anger. Until next time, goodbye.
Slip inside the eye of your mind. Don't you know you might find a better place to play. You said that you've never been, but all the things that you've seen slowly fade away. So I start a revolution from my bed, 'cause you said the brains I had went to my head. Step outside the summer times in bloom, stand up beside the fireplace, take that look from off your face. You ain't ever gonna burn my heart out. And so Sally can wait, she knows it's too late, and she's walking on by. Her soul slides away, but don't look back in anger, I heard you say. Take me to the place where you go, when nobody knows if it's not our day. And please don't put your life in the hand of a rock and roll band and throw it all away. So I start a revolution from my bed, 'cause you said the brains I had went to my head. Step outside the summer times in bloom, or stand up beside the fireplace, take that look from off your face. You ain't ever gonna burn my heart out. And so Sally can wait, she knows it's too late, and she's walking on by. Her soul slides away, but don't look back in anger, I heard you say. So I start a revolution from my bed, 'cause you said the brains I had went to my. Step outside the summer times in bloom, stand up beside the fireplace, take that look from off your face. You ain't ever gonna burn my heart out. And so Sally can wait, she knows it's too late, she's walking on by. Her soul slides away, but don't look back in anger, don't look back in anger, I heard you say.